Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, Park City Transportation Director Alfred Knotts and new transit manager Kim Felstead give an update on transit and housing for transit drivers. Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Haber recaps Tuesday's school board meeting. National Ability Center CEO Kevin Stickelman talks about this year's annual luncheon honoring military service members. And Wendy Lavitt, a volunteer with Nuzzles & Co., has details on the upcoming Casino Night fundraiser at Skull Candy on October 25th. Park City Municipal recently reorganized its transportation team, changing and making room for new positions, including a new transit manager. Joining us with an update on transit are Park City Transportation Director Alfred Knotts and transit manager Kim Felstead. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Emily. Good morning.
So, Alfred, let's kind of start by describing what has happened with the transportation department. Briefly summarize the reorganization here.
So, over the course of the last few months, as we moved into the new budgeting process, we looked at how to better organize our transportation organization, making it more of a comprehensive multimodal transportation organization. So, looking at active transportation, such things that Julia Collins and Alexis Verzen work on, parking, transit, and just overall capital projects and transportation demand management, and bringing that under really one comprehensive transportation program. Transit before was in its own department and in public works and operations, and then planning was in City Hall with me and with Alexis and Julia, and then parking was also kind of by itself also. So for all of these programs, strategies, policies, and projects to really work together, it makes sense to put them under one umbrella. So we took an opportunity to do that. And then we looked at the existing transit organization and those positions, which we had a transit quality manager before and a transit systems manager, which were Barbara and Kinsey Colson, and reevaluated those positions to be more traditional structure within a transit organization also. Transit organizations and districts and agencies have been around for over 100 years. So we really kind of reevaluated and looked at a more traditional structure and created more of a transit manager or a transit manager, and then a assistant transit manager also, and then reclassified another position within the transit organization as a transit service planner also, and then also kind of reimagined and reconfigured our marketing and outreach person also, and we've hired somebody else for that as well, and that's Andy Stevenson, and he's coming from us from Salt Lake City also.
So hopefully a bit more streamlined process.
Yes. Again, for us all to be working in tandem and everything, it makes sense to be under one umbrella and really have a real transportation department as opposed to these kind of silos or different organizational structures.
Right. So let's talk to our new transit manager. Kim, tell us a bit about your background in transit and why you wanted this job.
Previously, I worked for the Utah Transit Authority for a combined total of 17 years, and I did various tasks there. Started in the Capital Development Office when we were building the North-South line, and then I moved on to HR and Labor Relations and got to participate in two contract negotiations with the ATU. That's the union that represents their drivers. From there, I went on to be the bus manager for Meadowbrook, which is Salt Lake County Bus Service, for 5 years, and decided to leave and go into a defense contractor HR role. And after 4 years of that, I realized I missed public transportation and wanted to return. So I went back to UTA as the light rail operations manager for the last 3.5 years, and then decided to come to Park City.
So my first question really is, have you ridden Park City's bus system yet?
I have ridden it.
And what kind of opportunities do you see among Park City Transit?
I see a lot of growth coming and a lot of opportunity because the community support seems pretty phenomenal from my perspective. So I think that the timing of my arrival and the skill set that I bring is a perfect fit for where Park City is heading in the future. A lot of electric bus support and environmental concerns that I'm excited to help address those and help address the growth and the transportation needs of the future.
Right. And that's, I guess, a huge part of this conversation is, maybe expanding bus routes or expanding out into Wasatch County, potentially. Alfred, you could probably speak more to that.
But, I can.
but maybe that's a conversation for a different day. But Kim, you know, UTA is a much larger transit district than Park City is, you know, UTA spanning from Provo to, I think, Ogden. How can you apply that knowledge about a larger organization and system to our smaller one here in Park City?
I think what I learned there is the importance of processes, because as you become larger, it becomes more and more important to have a defined process so everybody knows their role and how things are done. And I can see that the timing is right to instill some of those here. But I think it's also important to keep kind of the family environment and the closeness that the department has. So I think UTA had a nice balance of that, quite honestly, even though they were much larger. And I can see that happening here as well.
So there's a transit schedule change coming up a bit later in the year, in November, I think you said, Alfred.
Yes.
But let's talk about some bus news that's coming up sooner. We've got Halloween coming up in a few weeks, and we're testing out something special on the buses.
Yes. It depends who you ask if this is a good idea, but it's an initiative we've talked about some time ago with our council and so on, and we've heard from the public, and even Leslie mentions it sometimes as well. About it being a barrier to using transit on certain events or certain times of year, and that's having dogs on buses. It may sound a little juvenile or anything, but we're very excited about it because the element of the dog parade and the Halloween during that time is important and to be able to get our locals on the bus. Halloween is considered a very local event. So we look to remove that barrier and to allow people to bring the dogs on the buses. Now, let me be very clear. We're just doing it on this one day, and we're going to do it as a pilot and see how the community responds and how responsible pet owners can be. And there are certain provisions that we're going to have that the dog needs to be very well behaved, needs to be leashed, can't be on the seats. And we'll get some of that information out to the community. But we think it's a very exciting test period. And then potentially look at during certain times of the other year, maybe spring and summer when it's more it's more conducive to that rather than being in the winter with people with ski boots and dogs on the bus with skiers and everything too. So I think it'll be exciting. It'll be fun. And we look to hear back from the community on this too. But we do really want the community to be responsible and responsive to this and respond accordingly.
Talk about the policy. I mean, why aren't dogs allowed on buses as is?
There's a a certain level of liability. And then also we've had some concerns from people in the public that are allergic to dogs and things like that, and even people that are just really apprehensive around dogs too. And being in a tourist town, you know, it's kind of you don't want to, you know, there's just a different market there that people may not expect to see that on a bus. So I think we can work towards a policy potentially for certain times of year, as I said. So,
but this is a pretty big event where there are a lot of dogs that that are out and about. Is this pilot program potentially going to overwhelm the system? I mean, would it have been better to test out dogs on buses when there were maybe fewer dogs, going around the community?
That's something we did talk about, but again, I think it helps support the event. So I think that's really what we're trying to achieve here. And we're trying to get people to access our events using public transit, and they have responded accordingly. In this event specifically, that is a barrier to some people being able to ride the bus to the event. So that's why we selected this event.
So let's talk about bus stops. I ride the white bus in from Kimball Junction, and there is a bus stop on 224 that's totally boarded up. So I'm hoping you can speak to that. But also, I know that we're working to improve some bus stops around Park City proper. Maybe you can give us a status update on those.
The shelter in question that you mentioned is out there by Olympic Parkway Boulevard. And that is a county maintains their facilities. We maintain ours. We have a significant amount of stops in the hundreds. around the whole system. So they are refurbishing that stop. I think Caroline and Jamie refer to that as it's going to look mountain chic, is what she's referring to it as. But they are, you know, trying to chip away at these things. People probably don't realize what an endeavor and how expensive some of these shelters can be. So they're really just doing kind of a retrofit on that one. We, on the other hand, are looking at our kind of high capacity or high volume stops, and those being Park Avenue condos and then Fresh Market. So we're looking to fully redesign that. In doing so, we're really looking to reconstruct the whole area in front of Fresh Market also, because the sidewalk there is very, very limited. It's not very safe. The retaining wall's failing. And as you start chipping away at these little things, it starts changing drainage, ADA access, site distance, and things like that. So it is actually going to be a pretty significant project, and we're looking at improving our design also, that it's more aesthetically pleasing. It is part of our streetscape. It's part of our gateway entry corridor. So those stops will be very, very crucial to what we're trying to achieve in terms of aesthetics, ADA access, safety, visibility, and all of those things. And then we're also doing a full assessment on all of our stops in terms of amenities, potential amenities, and ADA issues, which comes with our federal dollars that we have to make sure that we can make everything accessible.
Well, on top of that, winter's coming, and it'll be snowing soon. Are our bus stops winter ready for this season?
Yes. One thing we'll be doing, too, is taking out the electric bike station soon to make sure that that doesn't impede snow removal. But we do have a full-time maintenance person on our side, and I know Caroline's used a lot of different county forces also to make sure that their stops are all accessible and that they're winter ready also. So I think we are. And then we're looking forward to, hopefully we have a lot of snow to remove.
Well, speaking of winter, KPCW has done a few different reports on the town's seasonal workforce. And we've talked in the past about how low unemployment numbers have made it tricky for Park City Transit to staff up during the peak season. So maybe you can talk about how our winter seasonal transit workforce is looking.
Yes, we're actually about, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, Kim, but I think we're about 40 or 50 drivers short right now.
Correct.
Which is,
what does that mean for service?
Well, that's not atypical. We're making a big push here, but given the unemployment numbers, which, you know, nationally I think we're at about 3%, and I think even in Utah we're about 2.6%, is that, you know, we make this big push at the end, and we've been successful in the past, but there could be that issue given the unemployment numbers that we might run into some shortages, and that really the service doesn't really get impacted, or the rider doesn't feel it as much. What we do feel is the overtime cost that we have to pay other drivers during that time. So one thing that we do and offer is our transit housing, and we've increased our inventory there over in Prospector by about 22 units. We have 13 at Iron Horse, and that's something we provide as a priority to seasonal workers versus the year-round workers. So that's been attractive. And then we also recruit very heavily up into the national park areas, like up in Denali and those areas where people are not working during the winter. So we make a big push around that area. Our marketing and outreach person that we hired has been going to bees games and things like that. Kim has a lot of experience in doing recruiting and creative ideas also, so those have been very welcomed. And then we're also looking at providing ski passes and signing bonuses also. This is something ski pass-wise that we did in Lake Tahoe at my old organization also, and something that was very attractive to people that want to just come work seasonally and maybe work at the resort during the day and then, you know, be a driver at night. So we're trying to pull out all the stops we can to make sure that the service levels are maintained and our customer service is maintained.
Can you talk more about the inventory of housing that we have available for transit drivers?
In addition to the Prospector units we have, we also purchased the Peace House and refurbished that as well. So there's a total of approximately 40 units. So that's a pretty significant inventory. And again, a barrier that we're just trying to remove from people being able to work in resort areas and very high cost of living. So,
well, Kim, I'm sure you'll be working closely with the transit drivers. What do you think it means to them to have that option of staying in town instead of, you know, commuting up from Salt Lake or wherever it is that they're from?
I think it's a very important option for the operators. It's important that they're not fatigued when they're doing their job, and being able to be just right next door and within the city helps with that factor. I think it's a huge draw and will help us in our recruiting effort, because it's a great opportunity to live in a resort town at a very reasonable cost.
Can you speak to that cost at all, Alfred?
It is about $400 to $450 is what we charge, and depends on the units and whether those units are double occupied. So it's about $400 to $450.
Do we need more housing for transit drivers, do you think?
I think that's a rhetorical question. But this really does support a lot of the council initiatives when it comes to affordable housing, when it comes to transportation, when it comes to sustainability, social equity. It really hits all of those. So the more and more we can find, but as we know, it's all very limited. But that's why we take the opportunity, such as the Peace House, when they moved out, we jumped on that. And again, looking at those Prospector units, those used to be Talisker, Deer Valley units. So as they turn over, our housing folks and our transit folks are constantly looking for new inventory.
Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you about is the numbers, because at a recent city council meeting, council member Steve Joyce and other council members made clear that they want to see more data on, what strategies work for getting cars off the road and what's not working. And I know that we have data for transit ridership, so maybe you can kind of share that with us. How do we compare to last year, and do we know what impact that ridership has on traffic congestion? Mm-hmm.
Yes, we have made a conscious effort during our joint transit advisory board meetings, and we'll be having one of those on October 29th. That'll be held tentatively at the council chamber, so look for that agenda on our website. But we provide monthly ridership reports to our advisory members and then to the public also. So over the last year, we've seen constantly double-digit increases, which isn't very typical in the transit world. Once you roll out kind of new services, it usually takes a while for riders to respond. It's known as transit elasticity. So for things to kind of, you stretch it out and for it to snap back. But we've seen double-digit increases, and over the last year, we saw a 16.5% increase in boardings. And I do use the term boardings because it doesn't really always equate to passengers, just
to be
clear.
That's on and off.
that's
getting
correct.
Getting on and off the bus.
But our onboard surveys we just completed, and those will be coming to council as a staff communication, do show that the majority of our riders, the high percentage in the 70s%, are one-seat trips. So there aren't a lot of transfers. So those numbers lead me to believe very, very well that we are seeing a huge increase, a double-digit increase, which is pretty significant. So,
do we know if that's from visitors or from residents?
Our ridership data does show. In the winter, obviously, we have a lot more visitors, and those are the people riding our bus. In the summer, there's a lot more locals and a lot more transit-dependent folks rather than the choice riders that we see in the winter. But again, I think when you look at transit-dependent, it doesn't mean that you can't afford a car. People move here because they don't need a car, and we see that a lot from the J-1 visa people and a lot of the people that work here seasonally as they come to Park City because of the transit system, not because they can't necessarily afford a car, because they don't really need one.
Right. Well, Park City Transportation Director Alfred Knotts and Transit Manager Kim Felstead, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emily.
The Park City School District Board of Education met Tuesday evening to discuss social equity, enrollment, and the district's master planning efforts. Joining us with a recap is Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Hauber. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
So the school board received a presentation on the Park City Community Foundation's Social Equity Strategic Plan, and one of the top priority areas is early childhood education. And of course, that's the school district's wheelhouse, right? So how much of addressing that goal in the community falls on the school district's shoulders?
So I don't know if it necessarily falls on the shoulders of the school district, but we definitely have a preschool program in place. It's been in place for several years, almost 4 years now. And we're looking at serving those students who are 3 years old and 4 years old. So it's a preschool program that we have located at each of our elementary schools. And so that's the population we've been focusing on. We've been encouraged to help those students be successful in school. And that early start is definitely a benefit, and we're seeing that in the school system.
So is this something that the school district works with in tandem with the Park City Community Foundation, or is this something that the district just does independently?
So we had already started this a number of years ago. So we were looking at those 3 and 4 year olds and seeing what was best for their educational attainments. Working with the foundation now is great because they have a broader view. They're looking at 0 to 4. And so a population that isn't quite in our wheelhouse, but one that we definitely see the benefit in reaching out to those families and those students.
Well, Todd, you presented on enrollment numbers for the district. Maybe you can give us kind of the main takeaway and if we saw any outliers there.
So the main takeaway is that we had forecasted flat enrollment growth. So we were predicting something around 14 additional students. When the student counts came in, they were about 15 below last year's count. So we're in that flat enrollment period that we had anticipated. We'd hoped to be on the plus side of flat, but we're on the minus side of flat. Not a big statistical difference. We're just watching the developments in the area come into their own. Some development projects haven't come on the time frames that we had thought. So we still anticipate growth into the future. There's still the long-term projections and the master planning that we've looked at to see that growth over time. We're just at a lull within that 10-year frame that we were looking at.
Right. Well, and I wanted to get to that, but first I wanted to ask, how much does the student population change throughout one school year?
So in the course of a school year?
Yeah.
So we'll see a change usually at the mid-year break, so around January when semesters end and the next semesters begin. We can see a fluctuation of up to 20 students come into the system. We can also watch that many leave the system at that time as well as families make their own individual life decisions of where they're going to be, where they're going to work.
Right. And how does that impact per pupil spending? You said we were on the negative side of flat, which means decrease, but a small decrease.
Yeah, it's so small that we probably won't even see a financial impact in that area.
Okay. And let's look at those 10-year projections, because I have that we've projected about 10% growth in enrollment over 10 years. Is that
correct?
Right? And so, you know, are we still thinking that we'll see that much? And if not, how does that impact our master planning efforts?
So we're still anticipating that over the 10 years. As you look at the data, or if you have that opportunity to go out onto the website and see the demographer's report, it wasn't a straight line from today out 10 years. It ebbed and flowed according to projects as they were anticipated to come on. And that's in the developer's hands. You know, if they have different challenges arise and it delays their projects, it delays our forecast. It doesn't mean that it won't happen. It just means it won't happen the year we thought it would. Okay. So I think we're still on the trajectory for the 10 years. It's just not happening in the early years.
You're talking about housing developments.
Housing,
I just
realized. Yes, yes,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. As they build more houses, more kids will come in, and that's kind of why we're planning to expand our school services.
Correct.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about the master planning efforts, because school administration and the school board wants to finish up that process this December, and the final survey has just wrapped up. Talk about what was in that survey and the kind of participation it received.
Sure. We were looking to get the community's feel on 10 different items or 10 different decision points that the board will have to face in determining what of the master plan options is most feasible or addresses the priorities of the community. So that survey went out. We've pulled that back. We're starting to look at that information. We had a preliminary look last night as to what that type of information was. In addition to that survey, we also had a thought exchange. So it's a platform on the internet that we host, and people are able to put a thought out there with regards to these prioritizations, and then a conversation ensues on that thought exchange. It's kind of a neat opportunity to see, well, what is someone thinking? Do I agree and I have an opportunity to respond with what their thought was, or do I have a different thought and want to contradict it or advance a different idea? So we had the two going. So we had the survey and we had the thought exchange happening, and that information is what we reviewed last night.
What were people talking about in the thought exchange?
So on the thought exchange, there was a fair amount of talk about the high school. that the high school should have ninth grade in it, and that it should be at the location it's currently at. There were thoughts about the middle school, so the grades 6 through 8, how should they be configured and where they should be located. So there were the thoughts about that as well. And thoughts about we talked just earlier about those early years, so that the preschool offerings, and should they be in the neighborhoods, or should there be a community-based facility to support that? So those are the types of ideas and thoughts that we're moving through that thought exchange. And now the board has the opportunity to kind of tap into that thought stream, right, and say, hey, of the options that we see from our consultants, which one fits that conversation?
Well, maybe you can talk a little bit about who has participated in these conversations. Was there any group that the school really wanted feedback from that they didn't see much of during this whole master planning process?
So I think we've reached out to just about everybody. We've talked to parents. We've had community members who don't have students in the system, getting their feedback on what they envision education to be and the benefits that they see of the schools here in Park City. We've talked to staff and to students. So I think we've had a pretty good outreach. We've tried to reach out even into the Latino community and having those conversations. You know, they represent 20% of the student population at the schools, and so that's an important voice to have in there as well. And so we've reached out to all of them, and I think we're having a good conversation.
So the school board now has all this information. They have the information from the consultants. How will they go about making decisions, I guess?
That's probably a good question for a board member.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm staff to the board, but right. I would envision that it's a process of taking the recommendations that we have from our consultants. You know, these are the pieces of facility goals that are out there for the facilities, and then this community conversation that we're now watching through the thought exchange to say, okay, what is matching up? And I think the board members will be looking at how closely can we get alignment with those thoughts and the options that are available to us. And then there'll be the considerations of cost of the whole project. What can we achieve? One of the thoughts that came through the thought exchange was be careful in that area. Make sure that we're not spending monies that we don't have to. Let's be judicious in what we're planning. And in fact, one thought came back that said, you know, if you have to give up some programming to keep the cost down, maybe that's a wise course to go. So those are all the inputs that the board will have to kind of navigate through those issues.
Right. Well, one more thing I wanted to ask you about, maybe two more things. We just had Alfred Knotts on from the city talking about driver shortages. And I know that we've talked with the school district about bus driver shortages, school bus driver shortages. Are we still seeing that at this point in the year?
We are. We still have a need out there. So if anyone has the CDL, you do a plug here. No, but we do have a shortfall. We're able to maintain our regular routes, but with great effort. We need to have a deep bench in our substitute drivers to be able to maintain that. People get ill, they have family events, you know, they're like normal people that have other lives that they're not always available to drive bus. So we need that depth in the system. What we're looking at right now, and Mike Tanner talked about this at the board meeting last night, is we've taken the extracurricular runs that have to do with the athletics. And instead of taking a bus driver off of a route and putting them on an athletic run, we're going to have to hire that out commercially and get commercial drivers to run those routes or the events for us. Little expensive to go that route, but when you don't have a driver, you need something.
Right.
And so we'll probably manage that way through this year, and hopefully we'll have some more drivers show up and come into the pipeline for hiring.
Had the district been able to budget for that, for those commercial drivers then?
So we did receive an increase in funding from the state to cover pupil transportation. So that increase is what we're using to cover that cost.
Okay, Todd, I actually think I'm going to have to let you go. Thank you so much for coming in. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. I'm Emily Means. The 9th annual Saluting Our Heroes Luncheon will be held on November 6th, just ahead of Veterans Day. Joining us with more details is National Ability Center CEO Kevin Stickelman. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So why don't you tell us how and why the National Ability Center came to host this event?
Sure. So in 1985, when we were founded, we actually started with a grant from the Disabled American Veterans Organization to serve Vietnam vets and teach them how to ski here in Park City. And so since then, military programs have been really one of the cornerstones of the National Ability Center. And this is our way annually of just giving back to the community and thanking the veterans for their service.
So why don't you tell us who will speak at the event?
Sure. So we've got some interesting speakers online this year. The first up is our keynote, which is James Bradley. And he wrote the book Flags of Our Fathers, as well as Flyboys, and Flags of Our Fathers was turned into a motion picture movie directed by Clint Eastwood. So really going to be an interesting speaker. We also have the Lieutenant Governor that will be there to say a few words about the service community here in Utah. And then we also every year feature a participant speaker, and so we'll have a showcase of one of the individuals who's gone through our programs and benefited so much from what we do for those military members.
Why did you choose James Bradley to come and speak at this event? What do you hope people take away from him?
You know, I think that one of the big reasons is we're constantly looking for new perspective on military service and what that means. And I think that with his history, the books that he's written, all of the studies that he's done, especially in the Pacific Theater, you know, it's just going to bring a new story and a new person delivering that story to the Greater Salt Lake community.
Is he a service member as well, did you mention?
He's not,
okay.
No.
Well, let's talk about some of the programming that you think really benefits veterans and service members at the NAC.
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes the NAC unique is we provide programs and services not only to the veteran or active duty service member, but their extended family as well. You know, one of the things that we believe is in order to fully recover or reintegrate into your community, you've got to bring your family along with you. They mean almost more than anybody else in most people's lives, and it would be amiss were we not to not include those family members.
What programming do you think service members really enjoy to participate in?
You know, I think it really depends on their level of ability, but certainly we have a tremendous number of service members that take part in our ski and snowboard programs every year. When we look at the summer programming, it's a lot of team building and challenge course and, you know, some of those adventure sports that we get out there. And another unique program that we do is a partnership with the National Center for Veteran Studies at the University of Utah, which really works on PTSD recovery. And so those are 2-week-long, really intensive counseling / recreation retreats that happen out here at our ranch. And those have been extraordinarily successful over the last few years.
Maybe you can speak to how you believe outdoor recreational therapy helps veterans who have returned home.
Certainly. I think that one of the things that we see from our veteran populations is, especially if they're coming out of a conflict zone with some sort of traumatic injury or PTSD, they come back thinking that maybe they're not able to do what they used to do. And our belief is that you can do it. We're going to be able to get you out there, and you need to have that I can mentality, and we'll show you a way to get back water skiing or horseback riding or hiking and camping, river rafting, skiing and snowboarding, whatever that might be. Through our staff and volunteers, as well as the special equipment that we have, we rarely, if ever, have anybody that we can't get back out doing those activities that they so liked before they were injured.
Well, plus fresh air does the body good, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Kevin, give us the details on the event on November 6th.
Sure. Saluting Our Heroes takes place at the Grand America Hotel down in Salt Lake City. It's noon to 1:30 on November 6th, and it's free to attend. So you can go to our website, discovernac.org, find the information there, and also sign up in advance.
Kevin, is there anything else you wanted to add about any upcoming programming or anything like that?
You know, the biggest thing is a shout out, a call to volunteers. We are coming on ski season and certainly need volunteers to support those programs this winter.
All right. Kevin Stickelman from the National Ability Center, thank you so much for joining us
this
morning. Nuzzles & Co. is hosting its Casino Night fundraiser on October 25th. Here with more details is Nuzzles & Co. Vice President Wendy Lavick. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning. Well, we're really excited. It's going to be at Skull Candy in their wonderful new building. And we're going to have all sorts of games to play, including roulette and Texas Hold'em and blackjack, craps, and we'll have a prize wheel, and there's going to be all sorts of yummy things to eat and drink. Admission to the Snuggle Lounge is just $25 at the door, and people can either pay with cash or credit cards, and it should be an evening of fun from 6 to 9, so we hope everyone can come.
The Snuggle Lounge?
Yes, the Snuggle Lounge is going to have some puppies.
That's what I was hoping you would say.
Absolutely.
Can people arrange to adopt animals there?
Not that night.
Okay.
They can do a pre-adoption. And then we always like people to make their decisions the next day when they can think things over.
Right.
But they will certainly be able to see a few puppies. And then we always have puppies at the ranch and at in Peoa and at our adoption center at the Tanger Outlet Mall. And also, I wanted to tell people that we have some really exciting things at Nestles right now. We're forming a coalition with a number of local rescues to help us when we go to the Navajo Reservation and the Ute Reservation. In the past, we've had to leave some dogs behind because we just didn't have room. And so we are forming this coalition with a whole bunch of groups where they will take animals, we will pick them up and then drop them off, and they will take them so that we will not have to leave any dogs or cats behind. And this coalition includes Cache Humane, CAUSE, the Utah Animal Adoption Center, and the Navajo Puppy Reservation. And our other good news is that our Purple Paw Program, which is our domestic violence prevention program, we work very closely with Peace House. And so far, we have had over 200 dogs and cats in our program since we started, and we've helped 100 women, over 100 women, with their pets while they stay in the shelter, and then they're reunited as soon as they can find housing.
That all sounds like very good programming that's beneficial to the community. Does Nuzzles & Co. get most of the animals from reservations?
No, we serve local Utah first. The Summit County Animal Shelter, which is doing such a great job that they don't need us as much as they used to. But we get many animals from overcrowded shelters in the Salt Lake area, and we go wherever we're needed. And they call us because they know that we will take dogs with medical conditions, with behavioral problems that they can't handle.
I was looking through your list of pets yesterday online, and I saw lots of cats that I definitely wanted to snuggle. But I was also reading through the frequently asked questions, and I think there's some really interesting requirements for adoption, like that the animals need to be indoor pets, and that Nuzzles & Co. will do an adoption follow-up later. Why do you think it's important to have these sorts of rules in place?
Well, for cats, we really would like them to be indoor cats because statistics show that cats that are roaming outdoors usually have a very short life of 2 years before they're run over or before an animal gets them. So we really think that's the best idea. And for dogs, we'd like people to be able to walk them or have a fenced yard when they're out by themselves. And we just try to protect the animals and also the people who are adopting them.
Wendy, how many animals are available right now?
Well, we usually have about 85 animals in our program, and they're at the ranch, and then we usually have maybe up to 12 animals going down to the adoption center each day. Every animal is microchipped, vaccinated, has had behavioral evaluation and medical evaluation. So we really provide healthy animals to people. And we are now the third largest animal rescue in Utah. So I think we must be doing something right.
Well, Wendy, the Casino Night fundraiser, that's October 25th at Skull Candy. And what does the money go towards? The operating budget or any special projects? Or
basically, we depend on donations, and that is just part of our program that will help us save more animals.
Okay. Wendy Lavitt from Nuzzles & Co., thank you so much for joining us this
morning.
Thank
you.